Hey, welcome back to Ecolution. This is episode 92.
92?
Between myself, James before me, and producer Nikki, these past few years on Ecolution show that the subject of the climate crisis isn't one that we've grown tired of discussing. Sadly, there is ever more visible evidence of the impacts, from extreme weather to forest fires, and just last week, a collapsing glacier which destroyed an entire Swiss village. But despite all of this, it does feel like the subject has fallen off the radar for a lot of people. But why?
I think it's mainly just fear of it.
Outside of people's comfort zone, they kind of want to stay in their own personal safe bubble and feel comfortable in their day-to-day life.
What we find is eco-anxiety is common enough, so people are scared to change their ways. Because a lot of people feel it's too late already, the world's just doomed. But yeah, it's important to just tell people that that's not the case, and even if you change it, one small action by everyone leads to a huge consequence then, which can help or negatively impact the world.
I think many people almost kind of watch on the news every night now and just like feel like kind of a twinge of guilt, but kind of thanking like God that like, oh my God, like thank God it's them and not me. It's awful, but it's kind of true.
They don't feel it's affecting their daily lives directly. If people don't think their needs and wants are being taken away from them, they won't strive to fix the problem.
People aren't looking, but also it isn't advertised that well. You have to look, and people don't want to look.
I do get that. It can all be a bit overwhelming. But for some people, it's their job to look into how people behave, how they respond to things like the climate crisis, and why they do the things that they do.
I am Professor Pete Lunn, and I head the Behavioural Research Unit at the ESRI, the Economic and Social Research Institute. We are a mixture of behavioural economists and experimental psychologists, and the primary thing we're interested in is how humans make decisions and what drives their behaviour. So we would typically run studies where we don't just ask people about that, because sometimes people don't actually know why they make decisions the way they do. We actually run experiments and studies where we record people's behaviour in different contexts, in different circumstances, if you communicate with them in different ways. Sometimes we will experimentally manipulate, so we'll randomise some people. So one group will get some information, another group will get different information, or one group will be in one environment, another group will be in a different environment, and we compare how people make decisions and how they behave between the different groups, so we can really see what is it that's driving the way people make decisions and what is it that's driving how they behave.
For a long time, the mantra of reduce, reuse, recycle has been a watchword of communicating what we can do in our own way. But just choosing the right bin feels almost too small for the scale of the problem, because alone, it is.
There are a number of problems because climate is such a difficult policy problem. The challenge is so hard. One of the problems is almost everything you do is generating emissions. Okay, you get up in the morning and you turn your hot tap on. You've heated the water. You've already probably got your heating on a timer, or you turn the heating on. You're almost certainly burning fossil fuels to do that in a boiler. Or if you're not, you're using electricity from the grid that has generated emissions, which is heating your home. So you're heating your water, you're heating your home. You eat your breakfast. Your breakfast has produced emissions. It goes into a fridge, which may be energy efficient or may not be energy efficient, but is cooling all of your food. You walk out of the door, you use a form of transport to go to school or to go to work. That's producing emissions, and the form of transport that you use, the emissions are going to vary. All of our everyday activities are producing emissions. The products that we buy, the clothes that we wear, emissions have been produced in order to generate those products, in order to make those clothes. And it varies hugely. You can buy clothes where the emissions are low, and you can buy clothes where the emissions are high. And that would be true of electronics products, of consumer durables, and so on. So it's such a complex problem. There are so many different things. And of course, if you want to reduce the emissions, what you've got to do is you've got to get people focused on what are the things we could change that would make a big difference, and can we between us all coordinate that change so that we're all trying to do it, so that we get a feeling that collectively we're making a difference, because that's really important, as we've already said, to whether people will do it. That's a hard thing to do. That's why it's such a difficult problem.
That ambition of getting everyone on board to work together is a challenge, especially in a world that feels to be more and more about the self and not the whole of humanity, which we heard about from one team at the BT Young Scientist.
Hi, I'm Roisin.
And I'm Martin, and we're from Kinsale Community School. So our project is about egocentrism, which is a way the mind develops in youth. It's about struggling to see other perspectives other than your own, and like a difficulty understanding other people.
It really was a personal experience with my own self. You know, I'm mad at these people just because I don't understand where they're coming from. I want to understand where that was coming from. And it was also, I saw it in my peers. I saw them getting angry with each other because they couldn't understand another person's perspective.
We found in our findings that egocentrism is just a common stage in adolescent development. In our survey, over 2/3 or maybe 3/4 of the adolescents filled it out were egocentric.
So really it's just about open communication, isn't it? You see a lot of echo chamber stuff online. It's giving you your own opinions back at you over and over again. And then when you have a real life conversation, it could be kind of jarring to talk to another person and they have something to say that's different than what you have to say. And you're not quite sure how to react to that then, you know?
I don't think it's necessarily something we can change, but it's something we can work around. Guardians and parents can understand, you know, children are like this. I should understand that. Pretty much it's there for your whole life.
Egocentrism is an inability to put yourself in another person's shoes. So what happens when we put our individual needs ahead of the needs of others, or the community as a whole?
People have worried about individualism in Western society for a number of decades, and there is evidence to suggest that that worry is important and real. There are people who suffer from loneliness and anxiety and mental health difficulties, and there's some evidence to suggest that lack of community support and individualism is likely to be related to that. So we know that it matters. Now, in a modern world with an internet and with social media, do we think those individualism problems are getting worse? Well, certainly some people do, and there's some evidence that our relationship with digital devices and our relationship particularly with social media and the internet may be having an effect on young people's mental health. And that kind of isolation and these kind of individual forces that we've just mentioned here may well be part of that. You'll notice I'm being cautious in my language here. And the reason I'm being cautious is because the jury's still out. I mean, there are researchers who are studying this. Many of them believe that. There are others who are not so sure. And the evidence isn't completely clear cut. What I do know is the case is that if you consider the opposite, so not is this individualism causing a problem, but can communities be a real force for good, and is interaction with friends and communities and family good for you? Well, the answer to that is an absolutely unequivocal yes, it is. And the more we can do to promote face-to-face interaction, the more we can do to promote community involvement and engagement, the more we can give time for families so that people are getting to spend face-to-face time with families. All of those things are good for our health and well-being. So the flip side, we can be sure of.
Right, so if working and playing together gives us a greater purpose, what do we need to do to all change together too? What's needed is positive collective action.
We call climate action collective action for a specific reason. Behavioural scientists like me, what we talk about when we're talking about collective action is where people's behaviours impact upon everybody else. If I undertake an activity that produces greenhouse gas emissions that are damaging to the climate, my action affects you. And if you do it, your action affects me. So we're in this together. There's nothing we can do about that. It's a collective situation. And behavioural scientists have studied how people behave in collective action problems for many decades, and we have a pretty good idea about it. And you're right. If we share the burden more equally, people are more likely to make sacrifices and do the right thing. If we can see that leaders in society are doing the right thing, we are more likely to follow them. We are more likely to do the right thing. If there is strong communication about the situation we are in, and people can see how their behaviour produces the collective outcome, and they can see that other people understand that too, and the strong communication, we're more likely to do the right thing. Now, it's true our society is full of, sometimes, poor leadership, poor communication, unfairnesses. But actually, we live in a developed country that by international standards has pretty high levels of fairness, has pretty good communication, and actually has pretty high levels of trust in government. We might not always feel that way, but often that's true. And there are successes. There are success stories that we can point to where people have got this collective action right. One of the environmental ones I would point to is a lovely project that's taken place in Killarney in County Kerry, where all of the local traders got together and collectively agreed that they were going to charge a bit extra for people to use reusable coffee cups. That was collective action. They all got together. They did that in a fair way. They communicated with each other. They did it exactly as a behavioural scientist like me would want them to do. And it's been highly successful. They've got rid of the litter problem and the environmental problem of takeaway coffee cups in the national park down there by engaging in that kind of collective action and getting those principles right.
That makes sense to me. Giving things up together is easier as you encourage within the group, which is good to remember because changing behaviours on your own is hard.
It's hard to move the behaviours what you've always done. Like, you always done it, and if you've always done it, it's like an everyday thing you do, and it's hard to change it. Just like with the vegetables, because I'm not a big vegetable eater. And my mom's always like, eat vegetables. Once you're always going to eat vegetables, you'll like them. And I'm like, no way. No way.
What would you find easy to give up? A Greenpeace study from 2022 asked teens in France what they'd be willing to give up or reduce to combat climate change. And 74% of those that have taken a plane said that they would happily fly a lot less. But given that Ireland is an island off Europe, would you consider giving up flying?
What do you mean, give up flying? I kind of wouldn't mind, but I kind of would be sad, because then you could travel and have holidays and go to your grandma's house and go and see your friends in different countries. But like, if you could still use boat, I would might be fine with it, but not really.
Have you ever been in an argument where you tried to say something wasn't fair? Like your brother got a bigger slice of cake than you, or someone else did something you couldn't? I mean, sure, those are very basic examples. But given the time young people spend online, it's quite easy to feel you live in a bubble, looking out, but alone.
Social media is a big one, obviously. You see an algorithm and you only see what you want and other people only see what they want. And suddenly you're this own person and you have these views and everyone else is different to you. And it's like that so much in life. People are beginning to create this, well, I'm me and you're you. Like, I think this, you think this, you're different to me. Don't talk to me. You're out of the normal, I'm normal, you know?
People often compare themselves with others, sometimes being harsh, particularly when they see an idealised life online. An influencer who has so much money they can do anything, it can feel unfair. And what happens when you live what looks like more humble life is that divisions grow.
I think the modern world has a genuine problem of inequality that's bigger than it's had, possibly not ever, but certainly for a very long time. And that inequality is likely to have different effects to the effects that inequality has always had in the past, which is it causes conflict. And that's understandable that inequality causes conflict. It's a pretty straightforward thing. People perceive it as unfair and they try to do something about it and it causes conflict. But now in the modern world, we can see inequality much more clearly because the internet has shrunk the world. So people in the poorest countries in the world know something about people who are the richest people in the richest countries in the world in ways that previously we didn't. And that also means our comparison groups are different. So if you grow up in a community in Ireland, you might not necessarily be comparing yourself all the time with your peers who are the other people in your local community. You probably do that, but you might as well be comparing yourself with people who you're watching online who are living in other countries, who appear to have completely different resources, you know, who might appear to be terribly successful and beautiful because they're curating their own image to you. You know, so inequality also is affecting people in a different way now because the internet has shrunk the world. And I don't know whether I'm optimistic or pessimistic about what that's ultimately going to do. You can imagine it producing better political movements to do something about inequality, and that would be the optimistic view. The pessimistic view would be that it's going to induce more conflict. And, you know, obviously, I hope the former is the more powerful force.
Not all change is good. And when we feel divided, we really don't want to embrace change at all. Unless other people are doing it too.
I think we've just adapted to one way of living and most people just don't want to go away from that sort of lifestyle.
I think people are influenced to do a socially acceptable thing so that they don't feel isolated from the crowd.
I would say it's what everyone else is doing. You're influenced by everyone else.
People just have one way of life and they want to stick to it. But if we want to have a better environment and a better future, we need to change. So,
okay, so people want to follow the herd. Faye, again at the BT Young Scientist, was interested in just that.
Why are some people so affected by peer pressure, maybe? Why are some people so scared not to follow what their friends are doing?
It is true that younger people are susceptible to peer pressure. That's absolutely true, and there's lots of evidence for it. And the way we can get that evidence is we can run experiments where we put people in environments and we can actually manipulate how other people around them are behaving. And when we do that, what we find is that people copy each other. So you feel uncomfortable departing from the norm, being a bit different. Is that effect larger among teenagers? Yes. But actually, adults of all ages do it as well. I mean, we can run experiments that can show you that 70-year-olds also feel uncomfortable departing from the norm. And if you put them in an environment where everyone else is behaving a different way, they're likely to change the way they behave too. When you think about it, this is actually a profoundly sensible human behaviour in circumstances of uncertainty. So imagine arriving at an airport in a country you've never been to before, for example. The first thing you do if you're a stranger in a strange land, if you're looking for the exit, is you look around and see what direction is everyone else walking in. And you walk in the same direction as them. When you're uncertain, it's a really sensible thing to do. Now, if you think about it, people who are becoming adults, young people who are becoming adults, are more likely to be uncertain about the world around them because they're experiencing so much of it for the first time. So it's not surprising that they're also a bit more likely to copy others, because that's one of the ways human beings deal with uncertainty.
I think that we really copy each other. I think that's something you kind of see every day, whether that's in school, whether that's outside of school. And I think some people can kind of get scared of kind of saying something different. And I think people aren't really used to change and they don't really like it when it happens.
One reason people are resistant to change is that it feels like people in power haven't grabbed the bull by the horns and changed the system enough to make effective global change a real thing.
In policy terms, in terms of acceptance by government, we've understood the nature of the problem for 30 years. In that 30 years, we have hardly put a dent in it. Some countries have put a dent in their own emissions, but globally, the amount of carbon going into the atmosphere has been going up at exactly the same steady rate throughout those 30 years. So pessimism is understandable. So far, we have done far, far too little to deal with the problem, and that pessimism is understandable. But it's totally obvious, if too many of us are pessimistic, it can undermine action. So one of the things we've got to do is get people to understand what actions are possible, to get them to realise that it is actually possible to put a dent in this problem and to start to mitigate, to start to get emissions down. And it is, and some countries are starting to do it. People will respond to what they see and feel. If they see that change is being made and that change is effective, then more people are likely to get on bandwagons and do the right thing and come on board. So that's the kind of process that's got to happen. But the pessimism is understandable.
Lots of people are doing amazing work to help solve this problem. As Shu said last week, we have 90% of the tech we need already. But are we communicating that clearly enough?
Our research would suggest that the large proportion of the population understands that climate change is a really big problem and is also deeply worried about it. The vast majority of people in Ireland also express a willingness to do more. They want the government to do more, and they express a willingness to change their own behaviour more. Now, where we run into problems is that climate policy demands a level of coordination and understanding across the population as a whole that's really difficult. It's a really difficult problem. Emissions are caused by multiple different behaviours in multiple different ways across every sector in society. And when we ask the public, you know, what do you think if you were to change your behaviour to use a reusable shopping bag, what do you think that would do for climate emissions compared to, for example, eating a plant-based diet? And what we find is that the public don't know, and many of them actually think that recycling or using a reusable shopping bag has a really big impact on climate emissions. Unfortunately, it doesn't. But eating a plant-based diet would have a really large effect on your personal climate emissions. So there's a real problem of understanding and coordination, because climate's such a complex problem. In my lifetime, working in public affairs for over 30 years, it is comfortably the most complicated policy problem I've ever worked on. So a lot of the issue is going to be about communicating what really does make a difference, what doesn't make a difference, and then how can we all help ourselves to change our behaviour towards the kind of behaviours that really do make a difference to climate emissions.
One way behavioural scientists are experimenting with changing people's mindsets is by gamifying the information to get the message across more effectively.
Often we have a model of information transfer, of learning, of understanding that any school child will understand. which is that it's one-way traffic from somebody who knows the information to somebody who doesn't, and you've a teacher and they tell you and you just have to sit and learn what you're told, right? This is not a good model of learning. I mean, we've understood that for many years. I mean, the way you really get people to learn better is to ignite their own curiosity, to get them to try to find things out for themselves, to make the learning experience have some narrative. So it's distinctive. It's something that they enjoy and has a kind of social context to it. All of these things people who've studied learning understand really well. So what we've tried to do is try to find ways that we can do that that might scale up. So we've run experiments where we've given people online climate quizzes as ways to get them to learn quickly the basics of climate change. And they would do the quiz, we give them the answers, and in challenging themselves and trying to guess the answers and having that experience, which is sort of unfolding before them, they learn in a different way. And what we've shown is that if you do that kind of thing, if you give people a quiz, it actually affects their support for different policies. So if somebody learns about climate change through a quiz and they get the answers from that quiz, they become happier with more radical climate policies, with things like higher carbon taxes and changes to policy that maybe if they hadn't done the quiz, they wouldn't. So that form of learning isn't just imparting knowledge to them, which it clearly is. It's also actually changing the way they view the problem. In a way, doing a climate quiz and learning about it through a quiz is a form of boost. What we as behavioural scientists mean by a boost is a very precise way of increasing somebody's capability. And in behavioural science, what we're trying to do is, instead of have people read chapters of textbooks and, you know, wade through complex text and have to spend a lot of time learning and swatting in order to absorb information and understanding, instead what we're trying to do is really give them shortcuts. And that's kind of what a boost is. You're trying to say, how can we impart knowledge, how can we get people to learn things quickly and easily, and hopefully in a fun way, in ways that increase their capability? And that's what a boost is.
We could all do with a boost, because all of us need to be shaken out of wanting things to stay the same from time to time.
So we did work with active travel, so people putting in bike lanes and pedestrianised centres to get more cycling and walking, but obviously to reduce traffic and car use. And what we find is that in principle people support this, but when a specific change comes in their local area, quite a lot of people tend to oppose it. And sure enough, we showed that this was partly caused by status quo bias. So that when people just even-handedly compare two town centres, one that's got more infrastructure for cycling and walking and one that doesn't, they tend to prefer the one that's got the cycle lanes and the nice pedestrian areas. But when it's their town and there's a change proposed from where it is now, where there's lots of bad traffic, the same people will actually say, well, no, I don't want that. Even though, in theory, they should. Now, what we've shown happens here is that when you ask people to change away from how things are now, it's like their mind asks a different question. Instead of saying, what's good or bad about this? So if I give you two options, you might say, what's good about this option A? What's good or bad about option B? And you might weigh the two up. Instead of doing that, what you do is say, oh, this is the way it is now. They want to change it to this. What could go wrong? And it's as if we have an inbuilt system as human beings in our psychology. When someone else is trying to persuade us to change, the first question we ask ourselves is, what could go wrong? And that's probably quite a sensible thing to do, because you don't want to change every time someone else is telling you to change. But that does produce a bias when it comes to making certain choices in our lives. So the key thing, I think, is to be aware of it.
We all want to make good decisions, and almost all the young people we met are willing to change or give up things. And some are precisely what's needed, because we all have bad habits.
I had a constant behaviour of buying bottles of water whenever I was out instead of drinking my own bottled water. I knew this was wasteful, but it was easy for me to get my hands on, and I didn't want to go like all the way out of my way for water. I wanted to change this habit, so I made sure to fill up my water bottle right before I was going out and look up water filters around my town so I'd be prepared.
I've had some habits that I've tried to change.
Sometimes I do eat too many sweets, but I like can't stop it. And then sometimes my mom says, stop eating sweets! And I'm like, no, I just one more. And it's always one more, and it's always one more, until the whole candy box is empty.
I think, like, it's hard for people to, like, change the bad habits, because, like, they might have done that a lot and a lot and a lot. And then, the, like, in one summer, just tells them, or, like, their self, yourself tells yourself, like, stop doing that, or someone else says stop doing that, it's kind of hard to change you like that. So then you're gonna have to start working with steps, and then you might stop doing it, but it's very hard. Say we're talking about something like you want to stop eating candy. Step one, put your candy somewhere you can't open it. Ask your mom to put your candy in like a locker that she has the code for, so you can't eat it anymore. Step two, eat the vegetables, and then you'll know if you don't like it or not. Step three, you might drink some more water than lemonade, and then like ask your mom to not buy lemonade anymore.
When you're a kid, it's easy to change your way. Like, it's easy to learn another language, to go to other state. Like, I'm on Ireland. I can come back to Brazil, the country that I born. But for adults, it's a little bit hard because their parents didn't tell them that they could do that when they were child. But our parents tell us that we can do that as a child because they learned it on life.
Combating the climate crisis is something that we can all play a part in, even though we can feel powerless. And that was a question Martin and Roisin had for Pete.
How would you motivate people about our age, 13 to 19, to engage in ways to help the climate change at the moment?
How should you make them more want to be aware, wanting them to not just think, this is what I need to do, this is what I'm going to do?
Okay, so what I would say to Roisin and Martin is, yes, it's true that people are, to some extent, self-interested and self-motivated, and actually younger people more so. We get more and more generous towards others as we get older. On average, that's what human beings do. But if you want to motivate people to act, if you want to get beyond that self-interest and that, if you like, egocentrism, the thing to do is get people acting collectively. Because the reason that older people become more generous is they get more of the fruits of acting collectively. They learn with experience over time that acting with others, being generous towards others, trading favours, working together in groups is highly beneficial, that the whole becomes much more than the sum of the parts. And this is something in life that we have to learn. Now, can we accelerate that? Almost certainly. If you pull groups of people together to try to achieve something that's concrete within a community, within a school, in a locality, and actually make something happen, the pleasure that you get from getting people to work together to do that and the experiences you get are what's likely to motivate people later in life to continue doing those kind of activities. So it's about coming together and making things happen successfully as a group and the things you learn by doing that.
Thanks so much to Professor Pete Lunn of the ESRI for taking the time to speak with us, along with the students at the BT Young Scientist and Step Aside ETNS. These young people care a lot about our collective responsibility to help change the world for the better. But we have to remember that as young people, it can't just be about climate activism.
I think the most important thing I could do as a kid, it's like play pastime with my parents, because life, we get an adult so fast, and the kid, like, we're just kid for some years, and adult, we're adults for like so many years, like 30, 40, 50 years, and kids, we're just like 10 years, 14, and it's a little bit bad.
Kids and adults together need to keep talking, keep communicating our feelings and sharing our ideas to help the world transition into a better way of being. We can use peer pressure for good as well as bad.
Well, it is an intimidating concept, of course, climate change and global warming and things like that. What's really important is that we have to learn to face these problems head on, because by ignoring them, they're only going to get worse. They're not going to go away. Really, the way to get around that is by organizing yourself, organizing your own thoughts, organizing the people around you, organizing your community, and figuring out where to go from there.
People are just scared of the fear of rejection. We want to encourage people to just get out there, talk about with people.
Seek advice. Problem shared is the problem halved.
Don't do what everyone is doing. Get out there and do what's right instead of following the crowd. And like, in a world full of algorithms, hashtag and followers, like, human connection is most important. So we as humans need to make that connection.
Ecolution was presented by me, Evie Kenny, and produced by Nikki Coughlin. Head to the RTE Kids YouTube to see what our panel had to say about behaviours too.
This is our
RTE Junior Podcast!
For more, search RTE Kids Podcast.